Welcome to the Revenue Builders Podcast, a weekly show featuring B2B sales leaders and executives. Hosted by five-time CRO John McMahon and Force Management co-founder John Kaplan, the show goes behind the scenes with the people who have been there, done that, and seen the results. If you enjoy our content, please subscribe, rate, and review the show to help us reach more people. Revenue Builders is brought to you by Force Management. We help companies improve sales performance, executing the growth strategy at the point of sale. Find us at forcemanagement.com. Enjoy today's episode.
Welcome to the Revenue Builders Podcast. I'm John McMahon. Hey, today we bring you three segments on sales leadership transitions. We discuss making the jump from rep to first line manager with Tammy Sexton, the Chief Revenue Officer at Skyflow. The jump from second line manager with Carl Cross, CRO at Alchemy, and then walking in as a brand new CRO with Terry Tripp, the CRO at Tynes. We begin with Tammy. Tammy's had a great career in sales leadership. In this segment, she talks through her biggest lessons learned when she first became a manager and what she tries to teach her own managers. So, Tammy, you've climbed the ranks of sales leadership. You have a great track record of success. Let's share some of the lessons that you learned along the way. So, can you go back and think about, you know, moving from an account executive to first line manager? It's important for the audience to understand, like, you know, when if they go from AE to first line manager, what's the biggest part of that transition? What's the biggest thing they have to learn?
Yeah, well, I was an AE at Parametric PTC when you were there, John. So became a first line manager at EMC. I think the biggest thing with that role is like, and it's something that I tell my managers as I promote them, this is probably a mistake that you're going to make. So I need to plant it in your brain right now. And then when I see that happening, I'm going to ask you to think about like how not to make that happen. And the number one thing I see is playing super rep. Because people get promoted because they're good, right? And then you think, well, I'm going to make everybody sell exactly the way I do. But you know, what makes your superpower may not be the same as mine. It doesn't mean that we both can't get deals done. And managers need to recognize when they're becoming super rep and when they're doing their AE's job for them, as opposed to coaching them and allowing them to. I'm not saying that you want to always let your kid drive a bike without a helmet, but sometimes letting them just fall off once is not a bad thing either.
Yeah. Well, that happens where there's two things there. One is where you believe that all the reps are the same as you. So it's cookie cutter. And you made that point. And the second one is you're going to be the super rep because you're going to prove to them that you earned this promotion. And it's really hard if you get promoted from the same group that, you know, like let's say there were seven people in the region and you were one of seven. Now you get promoted to be the manager of that region. Now I've seen that's where it really happens, where they try to be super rep. I'm going to prove to you why I was a great salesperson. And I'm still a great salesperson. That's why I'm the manager now. But they're not really managing, to your point.
Right, exactly. And if those leaders go on calls with their AEs and their job, they feel like their job is to show the AE that they can prove their value or how to sell it. It's not going to actually accomplish that. In fact, that leader, I mean, and I've probably promoted 20 people into management roles, first line management roles. And I think out of the 20, 19 of them showed the super rep. And it's really then at that point, if you plant the seed, like this is what I see new managers doing, that's a mistake. And then you kind of, I shouldn't say catch them, but you can play gong or chorus snippets back to them that said, hey, what do you think about that? Like, how would you feel if you were an AE and your manager like butted on that question and asked it? Or, and then, so that I think the biggest thing is being able to point it out and for them to be thinking about that behavior, because if you point it out beforehand and then you point it out again, by the time the third or fourth time you're pointing it out, it actually will be something that they recognize that they have to change. And I think the biggest thing I learned about coaching other people is telling them what to do is never really effective. Asking them questions so that they figure out that they could be doing something differently themselves, that's when you're going to actually have a change that's going to be a lasting change in their behavior, which is what you want.
Yeah. Telling people stuff or yelling at them isn't nowhere near as powerful as asking questions. Yep. But I think one of the other points on the super rep part is, especially when they're you know, they're cutting the rep off in front of the customer and doing things like that, is you're the most important person at the account is the rep. And you're disrespecting the rep in front of the customer. You're not giving any power to the AE. So you're really taking all their power away right in front of the customer, which is really a bad thing.
Yeah. It's you know, you want to leave the call with like an executive saying you're in good hands with XYC AE or whatever. And making that AE. And then a lot, I've seen a lot of new managers, like when the deal gets juicy and it's time to negotiate, that's when they kind of come in and take over. And for the AEs, that's the fun part of the deal. Like taking that away from them makes them not want to be on your team anymore. So if you think about the bigger issue you have as a leader is to be able to empower and scale your organization, taking that fun part away from them is not really going to help you with your long-term goals. And if you do it the right way, AEs can definitely be coached to make sure that, you know, you don't want to ever sacrifice a deal either, but just be cognizant of that as a new leader, I think was a big, it was a mistake I made. It was a mistake I see almost every new manager make at that first level up.
Up next is Carl Cross. Carl has held several sales leadership roles before heading up the team at Alchemy. In this segment, we talk to Carl about making that shift to second line leader.
Yeah, I think the big leap there is, and you kind of touched on, John, which I think is what you know, for me was a learning. Number one, you're obviously driving results through leaders, right? And there's something different about that, right? I mean, if you think about what makes a great first line leader, I mean, there's a lot of things that make a great first line leader, but you know, they represent the values of the company, you know, better than anybody. They understand the leading indicators of the business. So they understand their, you know, all their metrics, like their pipeline. They understand the math equations behind that. They're one of the best at selling the company's offerings, right? So, you know, if you're going to lead, you got to show them that you can do it. Then you teach them, and then they got to demonstrate that there's objective evidence that they can do it. And then they're great storytellers, right? And so you have to think in terms of when you're leading first line leaders, you know, those are the things in my mind that make great first line guys, right? Now, the mistake that I see a lot of second line make is what you touched on, which is you'll have a tendency to run around them and go straight to the field like you're a first line manager and you rip the steering wheel out of their hands. And that just creates, you know, they feel chastised. It creates a sense of animosity. And then the individual contributors actually see that that's happening. And so you devalue that first line leader. And so for me, getting through that, those are all learned skills. You know, it's the thing I've learned is, I mean, we've all been very successful, right? I've never moved into a role that was a step up, whether it was a first line, second line, or CRO, where I was qualified for the role. It's about being not qualified for it, but I was prepared for it. And so, you know, it's okay to be uncomfortable, right? And the, you know, the further you move up the ranks, the lonelier it gets at the top. And so, you know, not just first line to second line, but for me, it's, you know, you second line starts to be a little bit more strategic versus tactical. They're thinking in terms of market analysis. How are they aligning the sales strategy with the business goal that they've been handed at the beginning of the year? And so you just have a broader, you know, your aperture opens up and you got a much broader view of the role. And then you got to go, you got to go have a mission and a vision to where you're enabling the first line leaders to drive results. So,
yeah, I think it takes a while to your point to get there. But typically what happens is what you first pointed out, where the poor reps are getting asked by the second line manager the same questions that they were asked by the first line manager. And there's no real quote unquote value add to the second line manager yet until they gain perspective and say, what added value am I going to bring to the table in addition to what the first line manager brings? That's when the epiphany happens.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, I got a question for you both. What I struggled with as I continued to move up the ladder in managing managers and managing managers' managers, I always kind of felt like my strength was in the field and my strength was with the troops and my strength was on deals. And what advice would you give to leaders that are moving up that feel a very strong connection to reps. Johnny, I think you talk about a lot, the higher up you go, the more you're recruiting. And so many of these people I recruited. So helping the managers recruit. And it was always difficult for me not to. Two things I'd like you to comment on. First is, how do you deal with that for yourself? And secondly, what are some signs that you're doing it like, this is a, you know, little outrageous, but it's happened to me before. A rep calls you and asks you for an update on the forecast, meaning you have the, you went on the call, you didn't do a good job of establishing who's doing what when, and you wound up with the task afterwards. So could you guys kind of comment on that? Like, number one, how do you fight it? And number two, what are some warning signs?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing, you know, your leadership team, you got to, they've got to understand it's their responsibility to set the performance conditions for the reps. And that's a two-way street, right? There's, you know, as a leader, you're a first line should wake up every day, and it's their ultimate responsibility that every person on that team has an equal chance of success. And there's a lot of things that we could unpack on that. Now, the corollary to that is, and this will be a familiar term that you guys have heard, the reps have a responsibility because they got to participate in their rescue as well. And so those things, I don't know that I've ever figured out the secret sauce, how you get that, just that flywheel effect going. But, you know, it's, I think that's just a continual struggle all the way up is, how, you know, how do you get the leaders to understand you got to, it's your responsibility to create the performance conditions, and then you got to hold the team accountable to it. They got to feel like you have their best interest as their number, is your number one priority. And then they have to be willing to step up to the plate and take a swing. So, I mean, what do you think, John? I mean,
Yeah, I'm going to just add to what you said, Carl. I think that you actually, if you're the third line manager, you have to actually outline, or the CRO outline, like segregation of duties between first line manager and second line manager. Otherwise, you get the second line manager doing exactly what the first line manager does. When you think about what a first line manager, especially a brand new one, is really not good at, they've never recruited before, right? They've never truly analyzed the strengths and weaknesses of their reps in the sales process to understand what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong, and really put their finger on, like, this is what's going right or going wrong with this rep. And then they've never really trained people. So I think the power and the value add comes in the second line manager, where they, one, are responsible for helping the first line manager recruit. Two, they should be in charge of analyzing each and every sales rep for strengths and weaknesses in their skills and their knowledge, and helping to train that first manager to spot that stuff. And then finally, that poor first line manager is doing all this stuff. You got to help them actually train the reps too. It can't just fall, all of this can't fall on the backs of the first line manager.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. I mean, like, you really broke our business down to its most fundamental part, and this is going to really make it elementary, but it's really about skills and pipeline. If you got a pipeline and you got the right skills in the organization, it's pretty hard to have a big miss, right? And you know, it's interesting, you know, as I've thought about my career, particularly as I've moved, you know, second line and beyond, you start to understand there's not a lot of I'm going to be judgmental when I say this. A lot of first line managers have never had the formal training of what does it mean to be a leader, right?
Right.
I mean, creating that platform of, you know, pipeline building, territory and account reviews, opportunity management, recruiting and retaining talent, forecasting, onboarding, and you got to go teach them, right? And, you know, what are the actions? And you almost have to lay the calendar out for them and give them the tools that empower them, and then have some success measures against it. And then everyone's got to stack hands and be committed to doing that and seeing that through. And then on the skills front, you know, most organizations, if you talk to them and say, hey, look, what's your success profile for or your key skills and attributes for your high performing reps? Most of them can't answer that question. And so, right, you know, the second, third line, are you willing to go invest the time, right, to go define that and do the work that looks at it from sales execution to sales knowledge to how they engage with clients if you're in a hunter-farmer model, or, you know, what are the leadership attributes that we're looking for, and building those, you know, that profile so you understand the foundational behaviors, like, you know, having integrity, that's a no-brainer. But then what are the success behaviors from the execution side, and then go recruit to it.
And now Terry Tripp, the CRO at Tynes. Terry talks about the first steps he takes as a new CRO. And we also talk about the nuances of taking on that role at a startup company.
But look, I think when you step into any role in a CRO capacity, and this was true for me as well, I think for me, I placed emphasis and priority on number one, the people. I absolutely needed to get to know the team. And that meant literally one-on-one conversations with every single person in my organization. Now, we're not huge, but that was still dozens and dozens of conversations. I want to know who they are, what they're about, what makes them tick, what their goals are, their ambitions. I want to hear what they have to say about the current state, what's working, what's not, et cetera. So the first thing for me is really getting to understand the people and frankly, having them get to understand and know me as well. So that was priority one. And I would say that that's key no matter what kind of new role you're stepping into. For me, then it was really a matter of digging in deeper, obviously through my due diligence of evaluating different opportunities and choosing to go to Tynes. You know, you're talking with customers and investors and things like that. But the next thing I want to do is kind of do a little bit of a deeper dive on what are customers really doing with our solution? What are the problems they're solving? How painful are they? Why are they trying to solve them now? Why haven't they solved them previously? Or if they've tried previously, what's wrong with that approach? So I really wanted to get into the, you know, into the shoes of our customers and understand really what's driving them to tackle this problem and choosing to tackle with us, and then get feedback from them along the way that, you know, I could take back to our product org or our go-to-market team, et cetera. So that was priority number two. Number three, I was also, through really both of those first two items, I was trying to listen for and identify what are maybe some early unlocks, some kind of blockers that maybe I could tackle that would allow us to maybe have some quick wins, if you will, some things that maybe were just holding us back unnecessarily that would really help propel us with some good growth. So I was looking for obviously a strategic view, but also looking for some near-term opportunities in the process. Those are the three things I was focused on.
Yeah. And when you walk into these things, especially when you walk into like a startup or almost any startup, what did you know you wouldn't find?
Well, I knew I probably wouldn't find like perfection anywhere, you know, early right. on. Something's broken, you know, whether that's something in the product that's not yet up to snuff or what have you. I think what I was really prepared for to not find is what was really like a repeatable sales process. You know, when it's a young organization, again, we're early growth. It's really, you're trying to win business all over the place. You're trying to win all deals. You want to really get your flag planted, get, you know, logos captured, et cetera. And as a result of that, it is a little bit of the Wild West. And so I think what I found and was expecting is, you know, not like a crystallized machine factory of a repeatable sales process. And that turned out to be true. And again, that's not bad. That's just the reality of kind of an early company.
No, it's really typical. Like you said, a lot of times you're first doing product market fit and almost anything can happen at that stage. And then you're just trying to do deals and you're trying to take anything you can off the street. And some people at that stage are like really artists. Some have their own sales process, but overall there's usually not a built-in, well-defined sales process with some discipline around it. So that's pretty typical that you won't find that, you know, when you first walk into a startup.
Yeah.
So you did say that it's important to have a well-defined sales process. Tell me why you believe that's true.
Well, I think that, again, as you mentioned in the beginning with some of the different experiences that I've had with, you know, obviously working at places with your leadership and in different stages of growth and different sizes of organizations, that fundamental is you got to get everybody that's kind of speaking the same language. you got to get everybody. And that doesn't just mean on the sales and the account teams. Ultimately, that means, frankly, the go-to-market org for sure, and beyond that, product org, et cetera. So one, I think, important part of a well-defined process is everybody understands what it means when a deal is at a certain stage, what it means when we use certain terminology as we're talking about deals and where they live, et cetera. I think as you get in the mode of trying to grow and scale, it becomes more important even because you've got to have that framework that everyone is anchored around. You've got to be able to know that best practices are being largely adopted and followed, you know, no matter where you are, you know, in the market or in the world, et cetera. And so it's really, I think, the lever that starts to propel the growth and the repeatability and kind of the best practices around the sales org.
Yeah, I think it's also important for training. You know, if you have a well-defined sales process, you kind of know where or what step or what stage of the sales process that some of your people are having a really difficult time. And then you know, okay, if they're having a tough time finding a champion or getting an economic buyer meeting or something like that, you know exactly what to train them on. If you don't have a well-defined sales process, you can't really see any patterns.
100%. Absolutely. And I think the good thing about having that process, and if you've again got good, clear criteria for each stage that you can measure and really pay attention to, you can kind of marry what you're seeing at a little bit more of a macro lens along with what you're hearing from the street, what you're experiencing when you're on calls with the team or what you're hearing from your frontline managers or the SE org, et cetera. So it's a great way to kind of bring those two together and look for those enablement opportunities that probably aren't isolated. You find it somewhere, it's probably happening somewhere else, and it's an opportunity to kind of bring that enablement up to the org level as a whole.
There were some great best practices here from Tammy Sexton, Carl Cross, and Terry Tripp. Thanks to everyone for listening to this episode of Revenue Builders Podcast. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Be sure to check us out at forcemanagement.com.